Welcome to Pod to the Rescue, a podcast from Summit Dog Rescue in Boulder, Colorado.
I'm Emily.
And I'm Libby.
We're both professional dog trainers with multiple certifications in dog training and behavior. Together, we have more than two decades of experience in dog rescue.
We want to share everything we've learned along the way with other folks involved in dog rescue, sheltering, fostering, and adoption, and anyone who just loves dogs.
Rescuing the dog is just the first step.
We're here to help with everything that comes next. Hello, listeners, and welcome back to Pod to the Rescue. I'm Libby.
And I'm Emily.
And today we are bringing you an interview with Tom Candy of Simplifying Shelter Behavior.
This was such an important topic that we wanted to discuss, which is fear in our shelter and rescue dogs. And we couldn't have found anyone that we loved to speak with about this more than Tom Candy.
He has an amazing podcast, Simplifying Shelter Behavior, and he's presented recently for PPG, the Pet Professional Guild, and he's just really knowledgeable and experienced in the sheltering world, which Emily and I appreciate. You know, our specialty is really foster-based rescue, so it was awesome to have him on talking about this really important topic.
And I feel like we only scratched the surface, and we'll probably have him back to discuss other amazing topics. So definitely hit follow if you're not following our podcast. And I hope you enjoy hearing Tom's incredible information.
A passion for animal welfare and training led Tom to undertake a Bachelor of Science degree in Bioveterinary Science and a Master of Science degree in Clinical Animal Behavior from the University of Lincoln in the United Kingdom. Having started volunteering in rescue at the age of 15, Tom now works as a senior training and behavior advisor for the UK's largest animal welfare organizations. Tom is also a behavior and welfare trustee for Hope Rescue Wales and runs a Facebook page and podcast offering free tools and tips for shelter workers called Simplifying Shelter Behavior. Tom is a certified clinical animal behaviorist with the Animal Behavior and Training Council in the United Kingdom and a certified canine behavior consultant and certified shelter behavior specialist with the International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants.
And that's why we had him on. What an impressive resume he has. So
he's an absolute wealth of information. And he gave us some really, really great actionable steps for helping fearful shelter dogs.
And rescues when you bring them home. So yeah, definitely follow his podcast, Simplifying Shelter Behavior, and hope you enjoy this episode.
Tom Candy, welcome to Pod to the Rescue.
Thanks for having me. Really excited to be here.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time. So can you briefly tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do in the sheltering world?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So, my name is Tom Candy. I've been involved in sheltering for the last 15 years. Started off kind of as a volunteer. You know, I wanted to go to vet school. As part of that, in the UK, you have to do a certain amount of work experience. Thus, kind of started standing outside shops on a Sunday with a bucket, talking about dogs in the care of a rescue called Hope Rescue, which is in South Wales, which is where I'm from in the UK. So that's kind of where I started. Decided I wanted to go down the behavior route. So for the last sort of 8 years, I've worked full-time as a behaviorist for the UK's largest dog welfare organization. So I started out working at a center every day, and now I oversee 7 centers across the southwest of the UK. So I support the behavior teams at those centers with any tricky dogs that they've got, making sure that we're upskilling our staff to give the best care and opportunities for the dogs so that we can work with them to improve any problem behaviors to make them more successful in their homes.
That's awesome. And it's such important work to have someone like you supporting shelters. And Emily and I, our expertise is really in foster-based rescue. So we're always really excited when we have someone with such vast experience in the sheltering world to come on and talk to us. So yeah, really, really grateful to have you here.
I started in foster-based rescue, so it was a really interesting shift going from that to a kennel environment. And particularly when I started in more kennels, the network of foster homes like wasn't very large. Like, we were quite reliant on people coming to the center, so that was a really interesting shift. And funnily enough, now whilst we've still got our sights, we are kind of moving more towards considering how we support our dogs in a lot of different ways, and that's obviously led to us investing more in foster programs and also looking at things like homestay, where the dogs are rehomed directly from the original owners to kind of keep them out of kennels. So it's really interesting kind of moving through all the different systems.
Oh, that's great.
I'd love to come back to that in more detail. I think that's going to be really relevant to this conversation.
Yeah,
But what we
definitely.
really wanted to talk to you about is dogs who come in and display fearful behaviors. So, can you just give us a quick overview of what that might look like in the shelter and kennel environment?
Yeah, definitely. So there's sort of a couple of reasons that that might happen, but let's kind of just describe it so that we know exactly what we're talking about. So when we think of a dog who might be anxious or fearful or worried about something in their environment or the environment in general, that tends to be displayed first through their kind of body language. So we might see things like their ears back, whites of their eyes, tension through the body. They tend to be the easiest way to kind of explain it, because obviously we're on audio, is looking quite small or trying to make themselves look quite small, particularly in kennels where a lot of their other options are removed. When we think of their behavior, it could be generally trying to avoid things. So if you're going into the kennel or you're approaching a dog, they're moving away from you. They might be turning their head, trying to create a bit of distance, or moving behind beds or bedding again to kind of create that distance. And the reason we kind of see it in shelter is a few different things. So it can be that the dogs are coming in and they're already worried about a specific stimuli, like other dogs, new people, or different things like that. Or it can be that they're just finding the environment quite overwhelming. And particularly if we're talking about kennel-based shelters, there's all those different sights, sounds, smells, which they potentially haven't been exposed to before. And more often than not, they've also lost sort of a secure attachment in their previous owner, regardless of kind of the route that they ended up in rescue. So they've lost that kind of secure base that gives them a bit of confidence, and they're in an environment which they're finding quite difficult. And that's why we often see those kind of fearful or anxious type behaviors.
So how can you tell if that fear is, and maybe it doesn't matter, and maybe we can get into that too. How can you tell if that fear is because of the scary environment or if it's a more generalized, okay, this dog just has a higher baseline of fearful behavior?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So some of it comes down to where the dog comes from, like which route they take to come into shelter. If they're coming from a previous owner, that's such a great opportunity for us to gather information about the pet. And whether you do that via a questionnaire or you have somebody sit and talk to the owner to find out what are their responses to new people, other dogs, new environments, cars, anything like that that they might experience when they move in. If we don't have any history, which is quite often the case, if they've come in from a stray or they've come in for any other reason and we just don't really know anything about them, we can do that through kind of observational assessment. So looking at them in different environments, so that might be like a real life room if you're lucky to have that sort of facility, or even just out and about. And what we might find as well is that the behavior is less consistent. So if it's very much about the environment, we're probably going to see it a lot more of the time. Whereas if it's specifically related to a trigger, you're probably only really going to see it when they're around the trigger. Now, the tricky part with that is if it's something like other dogs or new people, well, rescues and shelters are full of them because everybody's a new person and there's often other dogs there. So it can be really tricky for us to kind of weed it out. And like you said, sometimes it doesn't really matter because our treatment plan, which I'm sure we'll talk about, will kind of look similar. But it is important when we then think about what's the best journey for that dog. Because, like you said earlier, sometimes if we've got a dog and we're pretty sure they're struggling in the environment, or we're struggling to work that out, we might want to look at something like a foster home to take them out of that environment and then just add to the pool of information that we've got about that dog.
Yeah, that's where fosters come in so importantly for some of these dogs. They just can't really show who they are in the kennel environment. So, what would your next step be? Let's say you don't have a foster home and the dog is still like curled up in a ball in the corner of the kennel. What would your first step be there?
Yeah, so a lot of it is about taking the time and giving that dog space and time to adjust to the environment and starting to build positive associations. The difficulty with that is, particularly when we're in sort of kennel environment or shelters, we've got to get those dogs out of kennels. They've got to be able to toilet. We need to be able to make sure that we're meeting their needs. So that's where the kind of time pressure comes in, where we might not have that if the dog's in a foster home, and we might have a bit more option to kind of just leave the dog in a crate, with the door open and let them come out a bit more naturally. As long as the dog's toileting and eating, we have a little bit of time that we can work on it there. And what we might look at doing is just consistently, so set times in the day, a couple of times a day, just going up to the kennel, just tossing some treats behind the dog. That gives them the opportunity to move away, go and get the treats, start to build a positive association. But what we don't want to be doing is kind of encouraging the dog forward with treats, because if they are a bit worried, we can sometimes get conflict. So I really, really want the treats, but I'm still a bit worried about you. And then when the treats disappear, they get a bit of a spook because they're like, oh, actually, I'm really close to you. So if we're rewarding the dogs behind or just throwing treats behind, it gives us that opportunity to almost have like a double positive experience, because they get a little bit more distance, which is often what they want anyway, and they're getting a really yummy treat or a really high value reinforcer. The other thing we can think about then is, how do we just create that positive conditioned response? So even if you've got a dog who's not eating when you're there to start with, we can still just walk past the kennel, drop some treats, walk away again. And that's going to take us a little bit longer, but we're going to start to build those positive associations.
Oh, I would love to go back to the importance of avoiding conflict, these conflicting feelings. You know, so many times you hear, oh, so and so says hand feed or what. And I would love for you to explain why we want to avoid those conflicting feelings in the dogs.
Yeah, definitely. So it depends. It's sometimes it can be a useful thing, but the difficulty is knowing when. So if we start off and we're not doing hand feeding, it means we're probably going to get it right every time. And the reason that it can be a bit of an issue is like I said, so the dogs can kind of want the treats, but they don't really want to be close to us. So it still removes a little bit of an element of choice, because we're forcing the dog to come forward to take the reward, or the treat. So when we're thinking about how we improve confidence, we want to link things to positive associations, so to yummy treats, toys, things the dog enjoys. But we also want to give that dog a level of autonomy or control of their own behavior and their environment, because again, that's often what they want. So when we see dogs who are lunging, barking, snapping, what they're trying to create is that distance. So if we can teach them sort of that other body language works just as well, that really helps. So throwing the food away rather than putting it in the hand just gives the dog more choice about how close they want to come. And we're almost resetting them then by throwing the food away, because they can go further away again, and then it really is their choice to come closer to us. So that's called sort of retreat and retreat. It's often, oh, sorry, retreat and treat is often called. So we're throwing a treat, they're moving away, and then they're coming back to us. So we're just offering a lot more freedom. And the other thing that we can kind of link into that, if the dogs are starting to get a little bit more confident with us, and it's something that I really like doing with fearful dogs, is free work. So ACE free work, which is animal-centered education. So Sarah Fisher's kind of model, where you set out different stations for the dogs. It's things like snuffle mats, different textures, and you just allow the dog to kind of explore their environment. And as long as the dog's starting to show sort of little bits of positive contact behaviors, like tail wagging, looking a little bit more happy when people approach the kennel, we can do that in the kennel with the dog. But if they're still a bit unsure, we might not want to do it in the kennel, because it's often quite a tight space. But it's a really great way of allowing the starting the dog off, exploring their environment, and then we can add the people in with the food. You're still removing that conflict because the food's going on to the different stations, but you're there, so you're pairing a really nice experience with the presence of a person. So it's another kind of really good tool that we can utilize in the first few days to help the dog settle in.
I love that. So, you know, it's not about going in there and petting them and telling them that they're okay. It's about giving them some autonomy, linking that with positive things like food and food seeking and trying to remove the presence as much as possible of the human is kind of a roundabout way of putting it. Like,
Yeah, definitely. So what we want to think about really is how do we kind of introduce things at their pace? And often if we're the one who's kind of doing the petting straight off the bat, that's like you said, they might get something from that, but ultimately that is us putting sort of the pressure on them. But if we remove that's then giving them sort of full control of the environment, which is going to help build that confidence a bit quicker. And we're probably going to more successfully move towards them being able to pet them. And then obviously we can do small amounts of touch and still link that with feeding, and still giving the dog the opportunity to move away. So if we think of the 5 second rule, where the dog instigates touch, so that's the first part of it. So they come in over to us, we can do up to 5 seconds of touching, then we stop and see what the dog wants to do, and we can reward the dog in between. So you're still kind of starting to then introduce the touch, but giving the dog control.
That's so interesting because right now we chatted a little bit about a dog that we're trying to rescue from a nearby shelter, and she's extremely scared. So the timing of chatting with you is so helpful. And she's huddled in the corner, doesn't, have any affiliative behaviors towards the people who come in to change the kennels. And she has made no improvements. And what the only like glimmer of hope they had was one of the vet techs took her into the office one day and she was doing paperwork and just, ignoring this sweet little scared dog. And the dog came over and laid on her feet. And she had the skills enough to know not to like then reach down and pet, So she probably tossed a few pieces of food and like that was the beginning of the interaction. So it was that idea of like removing the social pressure and then seeing how the dog can respond to that.
Yeah, definitely. And, like we talked about earlier, sometimes we often think about getting the dogs out of the kennels means, getting them into foster or moving them, which is a really great option if you've got it available. But even things like you said, if you've got people who are working in offices and they're able to just set the room up, have a couple of different items for the dog to explore with some yummy food in, but leave the dog to it, and obviously keep an eye, but just generally leave the dog to it, that can still be a really great option to give the dog that little bit of breathing space. And I often think of it as sort of a ladder. So, we think of there's so much going on that puts them a certain height up the ladder. And if they go to the top of the ladder, that's where you might start to see either the reactive behaviors or, like you've been describing, kind of the more shut down behaviors or what you could label as shut down. So even having some time out of the kennel is going to bring the dog down a couple of rungs on the ladder. Whereas if they're in that kennel all the time, we're just fighting against kind of a losing battle. And it's more kind of based at foster homes, but interestingly, there was some research that was done a few years ago, and even having sort of 48 hours in a foster home, the cortisol levels came right down. They went back up slightly when the dogs went back into kennels, but not to the level they were previously before the foster visit. So it just shows that even short periods of times out of kennels, in offices, in foster homes, can give us that sort of way in to really start to develop the dog's confidence.
Okay, so if you were coaching one of the fosters in your program and you had one of these really fearful dogs or, even just a mildly fearful dog going into their home, how would you prepare them for that situation?
Yeah, so I think the first thing we want to think about is how we're going to set up that environment. So have they got a space in their home which is low traffic, so where it has less footfall? So for example, we might not want to set a fearful dog's bed and resources up in a hallway where that goes from the living room to the kitchen and you're constantly kind of getting up to, well, in the UK we'd be getting up to make cups of tea, or you might be going and getting a coffee or whatever, where there's going to be a lot of movement to and fro. So we want a kind of area which is a bit quieter, and then we want to think about how we're going to set that area up. So can they have a nice safe space? For some dogs that might be a crate which we can cover, which offers a bit of visual blocking as well. For other dogs they might prefer like an open bed, but still somewhere nice and comfy they can go, and they can start to have sort of a little bit of control over that environment. So the rule being, if they're in that space, we don't really go over to them, and they learn then, if I go here, Nothing's going to happen. Nobody's going to try and interact with me. So that's kind of the really basic, simple first step we can take for setting them up for success. And then similar approach we would take to what we discussed earlier with the kennels. So sort of every now and then through the day, we either just go drop some treats in the area outside and then walk away, let the dog come out, investigate the treats, eat the treats, go back to their space. And then I would start thinking about how you then incorporate that free work. So starting to introduce things like snuffle mats, really easy things that just starts to bring the dog out a little bit, gets them to investigate different things. Once we've got that, then we can start building a bit more of a relationship between the dog and the person. And that might be little fun games like the cheese mouse, where you literally just have a pile of cheese and you start flicking the cheese towards the dog or just past the dog. So we're starting to engage a little bit of play. So another great emotional system that we can use to kind of really build confidence. We're then building a bit of confidence with food as well and linking that to a positive relationship. But a big part of it, even in foster homes, is that consistency and the predictability. So trying to make things as predictable as possible, having a set routine when they're fed, when they're taken out. So that's kind of the basic model that I would start with.
Can you say a little bit more about using play to help fearful dogs?
Yeah, definitely. So play is like a brilliant emotion that we have, and dogs have, all animals have. And it's really about exploring and investigating. And it gives us a really great feeling when we do it. So it can be a really great way to kind of build that positive emotion and resilience in that dog and build the confidence, as well as then starting to form those sort of secure attachments that we said about, which also helps give the dog confidence because they become a bit, they get confidence from you as well as themselves. So it's a really great thing. So what we can do is just start with little games with food because that tends to be an easier way. And then look at what do they enjoy. Do they enjoy toys as well? Or if they're not as into toys, we can think about, well, how do we use our food in a way that's going to be fun? So, like I said, you can do the flicking, you can move it about a bit. We might start doing some really simple scent work, so hiding the food. So, again, the dog's exploring, but you're kind of doing it together. So, as long as you're not aware of any food issues, like any food guarding, we can start kind of pointing to areas where we've hidden the food. And then it makes it very much a partnership. So, you and the dog working together to kind of problem solve or reach the goal of getting the food or the toy. And then we can take that out and about, which is again just going to give the dog that confidence with you as that partnership to explore the world more than they would have if they were just kind of relying on themselves.
So all of these systems are working together to create confidence in the dog and a positive association to people in their environment.
Yeah, definitely. That's what we want to aim for. I think it's just important to mention as well, I'm not a vet, but if sometimes if we've got dogs who are really, really shut down and we're trying this stuff and we're not really seeing improvement, that might be a good time for us to speak to an experienced vet or a vet behaviorist about some extra support for dogs. And that can look like different things. And obviously, the vet's going to be the best person to talk about that. But sometimes we can do this stuff and it still not be enough. And they might just need a little extra help. And I know that the dog you was just talking about has already started that in the shelter, which is amazing because that's really going to help the transition into the home.
So really what I'm hearing is that, the brain has different ways that we process information, and like a very shut down dog would be in that fight or flight mode, right? Or freeze. There's is the fight or flight or freeze. So they're freezing. And what you're doing is trying to coax them into using different systems, like the play, in using different parts of their brain to engage in things that are not just being stuck in that frozen, I'm so terrified, I don't want to move. And then they start to have some confidence by moving out of that pathway. Is that a way of ex describing it?
Yeah, definitely. I think so. It's about teaching the dog that they're like, A, it's about building that positive association, like you said. So, either if we're talking about a dog who isn't generally anxious, they're more worried about a specific thing, building a positive association with that thing, but also then thinking about other behaviors that can A, make the dog feel better. So, I can take myself off and get distance. Or if I look at my handler, then we move further away from the scary thing. But so we're building that positive association, but we're also giving the dog better coping strategies so that then they feel a bit more comfortable because they know how to make themselves feel better. Whereas when they get to the point of that freeze, like you said, the sort of shut down freeze, they don't really know what to do. They're in that fight and flight mode and they're not really learning, they're not really experiencing anything. So we want to be able to make them feel better, but also provide them coping strategies so that they can start to feel better in themselves as well.
And I love your point about medical support for these dogs, because not only can you, is it important to maybe work with a vet on potentially some behavior medications, but we've also seen dogs who are extremely fearful who have a medical issue going on that needs treatment.
Yeah, 100%. So the other thing that we want, and it might be tricky because the dog might be, it might be detrimental for the dog to see the vet at that point. So we've kind of got to do a cost benefit analysis for that. But you're right, another massive reason that dogs can be fearful, or particularly where they get to the point where they're, shut down or beyond, is because they've got pain or something else going on. And that once we want that to be our first kind of protocol for trying to rule out or support, because if we've got that medical issue that we're not aware of or we're not addressing, any behavior modification or any behavior work that we try and do is going to be negatively affected by that. So we're not going to get the best effect we can if we've got a medical condition that we're not working on. So we always need to weigh up that item of, well, do we get the dog to see the vet? Make sure that we're supporting the dog in the right way and then work on building the confidence. And I think that's a really important part as well, is it's, and it's tricky for each individual case to know what's the right route, but sometimes it might be better to do all of the nasty, in inverted commas, things at the start when the dog's already a bit stressed, because that's going to give you that, that means it's all done then, and you can really work on building the dog's confidence and changing how they feel about it. Whereas sometimes if we wait and then we start to build the dog's confidence, but then they have to have a vet visit, that's potentially going to put us on the back step for all of the work we've already done. So it's a really tricky one because none of us want to be putting dogs into situations that we know they're going to struggle in. But sometimes it's the best of two evils. So sometimes we've just got to make sure that that dog, that we're not missing anything from the medical, that the dog is fit and well to the best of our knowledge, so that we've got a clean slate and a great foundation to start to build that confidence.
Yeah, that is tricky. This dog that we're working on right now, it turns out she went into heat and they're thinking that they're going to do the spay, and it's that same debate of like, do we do it now and just get everything, you know, that's traumatic behind her? And I think that's going to be the route that we go. But yeah, it's hard. It's like she's already totally scared and now she's going to go in for major surgery and recover and be in pain. But the hope is that everything will be behind her, and then she has a really great foster lined up, and we can hopefully just go really slow and build her confidence.
Yeah, I think a lot of stuff that we do in shelter, particularly when we're talking about shelter behavior, is that cost benefit analysis, because some dogs might be 95% to the way being ready to go home, but then an absolutely fantastic home comes forward. Well, are we gonna miss, do we want to miss out on that home because the dog's not quite ready? So you're kind of constantly weighing up the scales to work out what's going to be best for the dog, what's going to be the most appropriate outcome for the potential owner or the rescue. So I think everything we do just becomes a bit more of a challenge, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it's so hard because if you think about it, you know, there's so much in the shelter to be scared about. So you're trying to like weed out exactly what's going on with this dog and prep it, hopefully, for someone to want to invite it into their lives and be their family pet, which is tricky because, you know, people want to have a dog that can interact with family members, be around at Thanksgiving, you know, those kind of things. So it's a slow process, and it's amazing that your shelter system has has you to oversee all these shelters. Just kind of curious of like how things are in England versus, I think most of our listeners, when we look at our statistics, are in the United States. So can you tell us just a little bit about like what's the sheltering system like over there, and how many dogs are there coming into your shelters, like generally, who are fearful?
It's a really great question. I think it varies quite a lot, similar to the States. So we have maybe three or four large sort of national organizations. So that's big charities that have lots of sites or are multi-sites, and they cover quite a wide area. And then similarly, we have smaller rescues, which are a bit more localized, and they might be foster based or might have a much smaller kennels. So it kind of depends. But like the States, we've seen a big increase, and it's been really interesting post-COVID, because I think everybody who worked in sheltering was quite worried about COVID. In the UK, the actual COVID period wasn't as bad as we were expecting. And actually, in lots of cases, it was really good. Like, quite a lot of dogs who had been in the shelter system for quite a long time found homes. There wasn't really many dogs waiting to come in, so we're able to support sort of dogs in different areas. But what we're seeing now is, and this relates sort of specifically to your question about fearful dogs, what we're seeing now is a lot of dogs who missed out on a lot of opportunities for socialization and positive experiences because of COVID. They've now reached adolescence, because we're kind of that 18 months to 2 year period past COVID. So they've already got quite a lot of anxiety or other problem behaviors, and now they're coming into shelter and just completely struggling with the environment. So it's quite a big shift that we've noticed since then, which is definitely a challenge, which I know is the same across the pond with you.
Yeah. I was going to ask you also about developmental stages. Like, how do those influence a dog being fearful and also potentially the prognosis?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So when we have a puppy, they kind of, or any species, and it depends on the species, but so if we think about puppies, they go through the different development stages, like you said, and some of that is based around so the socialization period. And the kind of idea behind that, if we think of evolution, is if you're living out in the wild, there's a certain period of time where you're kind of going to meet or experience everything that you need to feel safe around. So that might be, other animals in your group or the environment that you live in. And then after that period, anything else is probably going to be a threat. So that's kind of the evolutionary model of where it's come from. What we've seen in dogs is that it's kind of shifted depending on breed. So if we've got dogs like Garders, so like German Shepherd dogs, or dogs who've been bred previously to card, they tend to have a much smaller socialization period, because if you want a dog to bark at things that you don't want on your property, you want them to have a shorter time to kind of get to know everything. And then some dogs have a much wider socialization period. But that period is basically about building those positive associations in the brain that make us feel safe or make us understand a situation. So if we miss out on that, then anything novel in the environment, we're just not sure about, because all of us are designed to keep ourselves safe. That's kind of our primary reason, is to keep going. So anything that we're not sure about and might pose a threat becomes something to be worried about. And you then have different other you have other factors that then feed into that, like genetics, early experience, that plays into how important that period is for each dog. So you could have two puppies who go through very similar experiences from a different litter, and they might have a completely different outcome. And that's why it's really important that with any dog, we want to be taking socialization at their own pace and linking it to really positive things. So exposing them to things gradually and linking it to positive experiences. And I think before there was a bit of a move towards, every dog must meet 100 other dogs and 100 other people. Well, that might actually not be the right approach for each individual, and we've got to take that individual approach to have the best benefit from it.
I love that you're considering the genetic and evolutionary aspect of fear. In shelter and rescuing, we hear all the time, oh, this dog is afraid of X, Y, Z. They must have been abused, or they must have, you hear all sorts of speculation. But that's not necessarily the case. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. So, the difficulty is we often don't know the background of the dogs, and I think because of, and I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, because obviously I work in the industry as well, but because of the type of, often it's care-based people who go into care-based industries, right? So it's not just us in Charlotte, it's nursing and veterinary and all of the different things. So if we're care-based people, I think often we want to find the reasons why things have happened, and that might lead us to the dog's gone through something traumatic or something bad has happened and created that learning history. We know that is the case with some dogs, but often it isn't, and it can be they've just never come across that thing before, and then they might have had a slightly stressed mum or other genetic factors which has just made them slightly less resilient to that thing. So it might not have been a problem before, but then something has pushed them over the edge. And my dog is actually quite a good example of this. So she's from a shelter. She was really good, sort of maybe. So I had her about 18 months, and then but till about 4, absolutely fine with fireworks, no issues. Like we did avoid them, but if we were out and about and stuff went off, she wasn't bothered, no issues. And then when I started working at the different centres, we were at a centre one year on fireworks night, which I'd forgotten it was fireworks night, and we had it had been really bad weather in the UK the weekend before fireworks night, and it was really bad weather forecasted after fireworks night. So where often the big public displays would be on like a Saturday, they were all on the one day midweek, and we were out, and it was like a war zone. Like it was awful. There's so many fireworks going off. And we were in a new place because we weren't at home, and we were staying in an Airbnb. So now she's really worried about fireworks because of that one bad experience. So that was a complete tangent. I've just completely lost even where I was
No, I
going
thought that
with
was really interesting. I
it.
was thinking about it. Yeah, it's a great example. And I was, when you were saying that, I thought of the Jean Donaldson quote, like, fear is the easiest behavior to install and the hardest one to, I guess, modify would be. I don't exactly know her quote, but it's so true. And now that we're talking about it, I feel like in addition to just your totally shut down, fearful dog, dogs have fears. And then as we have them through their lives, like, those fears can come at any time. So we could even generalize our conversation to just work, how do we work with fears for dogs, and helping them survive our human world. I mean, when you're describing those fireworks explosions, I'm getting PTSD. Like, what a weird world for dogs. So now we like take a dog from, like maybe the countryside of Wales, and next thing you know, they're in a shelter and there's fireworks next door. Like, oh my gosh, so many expectations.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. And actually, one of my first entries to doing training and behavior was Victoria Stilwell's original program, It's Me or the Dog. And I always remember this one episode where it's a chihuahua, and I think the chihuahua is reactive to the male owner or something. And she makes both owners lie down on the floor to like see the world from the chihuahua's perspective. And it always sticks with me because I think we put, and not intentionally a lot of the time, but I think we put a lot of expectations on dogs. And we often talk about this when we think about dogs who come in from overseas or hoarder cases. You know, we expect them to go home where there's a weird machine that vibrates and spins and spits water everywhere to clean our clothes. We have this big box on a stand that makes weird noises and flashes funny colors, which is our TVs. And we have all of these things that we take for granted day to day because we're used to them. So we're used to the shower, we're used to the washing machine, we're used to the TV or the doorbell. But if dogs haven't experienced this or have a negative experience, you know, quite quickly we can move up that ladder that we were talking about earlier and have a dog who is struggling in the environment because of that lack of control, that lack of experience, and those negative, either negative associations or, like we were just saying, a lack of positive associations, which sometimes can be just as problematic for that dog because they just don't know how to react in that situation.
I think that talking about expectations is a great time to pivot to how can you help these fearful and anxious dogs in the shelter get ready for adoption? What is that process like? How do you know when they're ready to start meeting potential adopters? And how do you prepare the adopters for taking home a dog who has struggled?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think the way that I think about it in terms of like when do we think our dogs are ready for home, we've got to just consider those kind of basic husbandry needs for a dog. So, can we clip the dog up, take them on little walks, even if they're struggling in certain environments, can we get them out to somewhere that's nice and safe, that they feel secure? Can we introduce new people? And we can talk a little bit about that. So if we have particularly fearful dogs, what we'll often do is think about, well, what does the introduction plan look like for this individual? So if we've got a super friendly Labrador who loves everybody, they're probably not going to have an introduction plan. Somebody's going to walk in, be a good match for the dog. We're going to get the dog out of the kennels, go for a walk, and everybody's probably going to be happy. But when we've got these fearful dogs, we want to try and make those introductions predictable. So if we've been using free work to build that confidence, well, we might incorporate that into the introduction. Or we might have a very specific spot, so a bench or somewhere that we can take the dog to every day, do some really fun stuff. So do some play, do some feeding, do some enrichment. And we do that and we do that. And then one day there's another person there who the dog already knows. So it's like, oh my God, like another friend, brilliant. And then gradually we introduce somebody who's slightly less well known to the dog, maybe somebody who's out of uniform, because if you've got a set uniform, often that can become a bit of a predictor. So we might sort of introduce somebody slightly out of uniform and then build up to a completely new person, because that's going to A, build that positive association, like we've already talked about, B, offer a bit of predictability, and C, which we often don't think about, also set the owner up for success. Because the other hard parts of shelter behavior that we don't have to worry about too much if we're working with other clients is we still kind of have to sell the dogs, because our ultimate goal is to get that dog in a home. And we have some absolutely fantastic adopters, but often, like you said earlier, people want a dog who is going to integrate in their family. And yeah, that might take a bit of time, but if we can set them up for success and teach the dog to be relaxed around new people in those specific situations, and then introduce the person in that way, we're hopefully going to get more interaction from the dog. The dog's going to feel more comfortable, and the person's going to feel like it's a dog that they can work with and take home, because they can see those kind of little glimmers. Whereas if a dog's not ready and they're still kind of really avoidant of new people, and we put them in a run together and the dog spends 10 minutes the other side of the run not coming anywhere near the person, most people are going to be like, oh, I don't think it's the right dog for me, for whatever reason. And you can't really blame them. So but I think that's the thing we can do is we can do something that's going to improve the welfare of the dog, improve the dog's chance of getting homes, and make everybody happy in quite an easy way. We should definitely take that. So I think that's one part of it, is those introductions. And then when we think about how do we set that dog up for success and that owner up for success, obviously we've already talked about kind of things introducing to foster homes. But what we might think about is, do we do little home visits for the dog? So it depends how well the dog travels. Is it going to be more stressful or less stressful for the dog? But can they go home for a couple of hours and just settle into that environment without the pressure of taking the dog and knowing, well, this is it now, I've got the dog. So they take the dog home for a couple of hours. They can do a nice quiet walk. They can settle into the garden. Then a couple of hours later, come back to the shelter. Everybody can decompress. We can do it again. And if it goes well, then the dog goes home. So thinking about how we use home trials can be really important as well, to again gradually introduce the dog to that environment. So I think that's another really key part. And then the third key part that I think is really important is letting owners know that they've got support. So regardless of kind of your setup, like if you've got behavior staff or not, sometimes even just being able to pick up the phone and be like, oh, this happened today, I'm not too sure about it, and just talking through it can be a really big lifeline for adopters if they've got a fearful dog who's struggling, because it can make them think, oh, okay, this is normal, this is what I can do tomorrow to make it a little bit better. And you hopefully would get less dogs coming back because we're kind of supporting the owner as much as we're supporting the dog. So I think they're the kind of three main things that I would think about when we're talking about is the dog ready and how do we sort of help them in those first few steps.
I'm thinking now about a dog we had 2 years ago. His name was Benny, and he was like this big Irish wolfhound looking dog, and he was terrified of men. And we did a lot of what you're talking about, teaching him free work and giving him agency. And, we made some progress, and he was on some behavior meds, and a wonderful couple came to it. They wanted to adopt him, and they had the right environment. They lived up in the mountains, so he could be away from some of the things that scared him, which were like trucks and loud noises. But he was terrified of the man. And so the guy would come over to my house. He came probably 10 times. We became friends because he would literally lay down on the couch or on my floor and throw treats. And I was like, please don't give up. It's just like, because I wanted this dog to get this home. And then when they brought him home, we did a few home visits. Still, the human, his name was Ben also, which was funny. He would have to be on the couch when the dog was around, laying flat down on the couch. And now, it took a couple of months, and they are the best of friends. So it can take so slow, and you feel like this is never going to happen. And then once that dog feels safe and understands that you're not going to hurt them, and you have that bond and that communication, it really can become a success story.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's a really, really great story. And part of the difficulty is if we think of that kind of that key idea of, if a dog's struggling, then they want more distance, or we make the thing they're worried about a bit smaller in terms of, what they mean to the dog. So they're either further away or it's not as intense. Well, it's quite hard to do. We can do the distance part, but it's quite hard to make a person smaller, like we might crouch down so the silhouette is different. So it's thinking of like, well, what else can we do? So another big part of a dog's world is scent. So sometimes what we might do if we've got a dog who we know is worried, they're starting to feel a bit better, but we know they're going to go home with this person, is ask for an item of clothing. And we're not going to sort of put in the dog's bed or anything. We want to make sure they've still got choice, but we can have it around, we can start to feed the dog. And even doing that with the person in the room sometimes can be really beneficial because often what dogs want is information. But we then come back to that conflict piece that we were talking about earlier. They want more information about the scary thing, but they don't want to go closer because they don't know what's going to happen. So if we can take a piece of clothing off the person, take their coat or something, and just put it closer to the dog and reward the dog for investigating that. Again, with then building a really positive association with something that's really important to the dog, which is that smell. Because otherwise, it's really hard to break down. Like you said, Ben, probably quite hard to make Ben less present in his house. So we've kind of got to think of other ways that we can kind of cheat the system a little bit.
And when you're talking about doing free work, that's a great idea then to like have that person's smell as part of this positive game that the dog has been playing. Now all of a sudden that dog's smelling the sweatshirt, let's say. We should have done that. We should have talked to you.
Yeah, it's hard. Well, I mean, hindsight's
Ben did leave
50-50,
his
isn't
shirt though, and it was we just kind of
it?
had it around and kind of brought his smell into the house through that shirt, but we didn't incorporate it into the free work, and that's a brilliant idea.
Yeah, I think anything that kind of adds a bit of predictability is just super helpful. So the other thing that I really love is Leslie McDevitt's pattern games. Because again, like Libby could do them for a bit if Libby's the main handler, and then you could do them for a bit, and then when the adopter comes in, the dog knows the game really well, so it just adds that little bit of, I'm not really sure about the person, but I understand what they want me to do. And I always remember one of my lecturers at uni, Daniel Mills, who's a really great veterinary behaviorist, saying, and it's changed slightly now because Fear Free is much more aware. We're much more aware of dogs in veterinary settings. But what generally happens with a dog in a vet is they're put on a table and then the vet goes, "Here, have some treats." And they're kind of pushing treats into the dog's face. And the dog's like, "Well, I'm definitely not going to eat them now because you're weird and it smells funny in here." But often, if the vet asks the dog to sit, the dog's like, oh, I know what that means. They sit, and then they're more likely to take the treat because they're kind of in that process of like, bum on floor, I get a treat. So that tiny little shift can change things. So I think things like pattern games or teaching the dog like a hand touch, or a target, something that you can then ask potential adopters to do with the dogs rather than just providing food, can be another great way of sort of slowly transitioning to new people without having to kind of completely change that person. If that
I
makes
love
sense.
that. We pretty much use at least the 1, 2, 3 game with every foster that comes through the doors. And I love that. And I've seen that where the dog's like, oh, you know that game? I know that game. So whoever walks in, they instantly have a way to communicate.
Yeah, 100%. And the reason they're so popular is because they're just so easy, right? So like up and down, like put a treat on the floor, dog eats the treat, looks back up at you because they're waiting for the next treat. That's your repetition. That builds the pattern. And even things like Chirag's counting game, where you move to a different spot, put a couple of treats on the floor, move away, put a couple of treats on the floor. Just again building that association with following people, and it's predictable and it's positive. So there's no real fallout from it either, because if you put some treats on the floor and walk away and the dog doesn't eat the treats, nothing bad's happened. That's one of the benefits of positive reinforcement based training, is it's much, much harder to have a negative effect on a dog than some of the other training methods.
What are some other ways that you prep adopters and coach them about bringing home a fearful dog?
Yeah, so I think like one of the absolute key things is body language. So showing them videos. If you've got videos of like the dog they're going to take, that's even better sometimes, because then that learning is just solidified with the dog that they're going to be seeing. But obviously what we don't want to be doing is putting dogs into situations where they don't feel comfortable just to film them. But talking about body language, showing them videos, showing them pictures, and explaining what it means, it's really important, because when you're like, it's a really great feeling when you're doing a meet and they say, oh, he just lip licked. So do you think I should like just stop touching him a minute? And it's like, yeah, let's see. And obviously, not every lip lick means they're worried, but when owners start to recognize it, you just know that A, they've paid attention to you, which is always useful. And B, they're going to respect that dog's space and choice, which we've already talked about being super important. Important for building confidence. So I think any conversation that you can have about body language and making them more aware of what the dogs are trying to say is going to be really helpful for making that dog feel safe. And then the other piece is expectation setting, which we've mentioned again, because we want people to have dogs who they can introduce to their family and they can take down the pub over here, and do fun things with. But it's helping people recognize what level their dog is at now. So, yes, you might be able to go to the park on a Saturday in the future, but for now, you should only really go to this park when it's a bit, when you know it's a bit quieter, and build it back up. And I've got a system that I really like using for that, and we can get owners involved with it. So again, you get a little bit more buying, and that's looking at it in sort of a red, amber, green way. So you can do it in a pyramid or however you want to do it, and you basically kind of list activities. So free work in the garden for most dogs would hopefully be a nice green activity, meaning we don't really need to do much with it. We're quite unlikely that the dog's going to move towards threshold or be worried about it. And we think about these different activities, and they're going to be activities that we can do every day, and the dog's going to enjoy, not really have much pressure put on them. Then we can think of our amber activities, which might be slightly more tricky for the dog, because we want to, start to move them out of their comfort zone a little bit, but supported by us, which I'll come back to in a minute. But activities that might be slightly more tricky, and we might do them once a week to start with, and then every other time we're doing green activities, so the dog's got the opportunity to decompress, come back down to baseline, and really process that experience. And then we're going to have red activities, which are activities that we're just not going to touch at the minute. So they might come back in the future, but we're not going to do them now. And our aim is to get the owners to see A, the progress that we're trying to get for the dog, so that they can imagine the dog in the future. in a way that allows them to gradually move amber activities to green and then gradually move those red activities to amber and then eventually green. So I think it's a really nice way just to sit down with adopters and really talk about what life is going to look like with that dog for the first few months, could be years, like we know what it's like. And the way I think about it, which is what I said I'll come back to you, is when we've got a fearful dog and we're changing another thing. So they've left a home potentially, they've come into the rescue, now they're going to another home. That's quite a lot of change. So we might want to wrap them in cotton wool to start with, but we need to just gradually be able to remove that cotton wool so that they can be a happy dog in a home environment. And I think it's a really great way of doing that.
I love that. Do you have that as an infographic?
Yeah, I'm currently making a better one because
Okay,
it's
that's
a lot
great.
of squares on PowerPoint. But
Yeah.
yeah, I can send you the link.
Yeah,
So when they
we'd love to
first
share
come
that.
home, you would say you're in the green, and which means that little safe space in the house and really predictable routines and throwing food. And then as the dog starts to make some choices and do a little free work, you would like sprinkle in a little bit of the amber. Was the amber the middle one?
Yeah,
Okay.
definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, so what we're doing is taking the dog out of their comfort zone a little bit at a level that's appropriate. So if you ever did an activity and you thought this dog's not coping, then we would stop. But the brilliant part of it is then you've got the green activities to fall back on. So you've got that opportunity to decompress because often what happens, and we can do that. I do this with dogs in shelter as well, because often what happens is we say, right, okay, our dog's a bit worried about other dogs, so we're going to do a setup. So we might have a dog at a distance, and for whatever reason, the dog goes over a threshold and they end up reacting to the dog, and it's a stressful experience for the dog and for that handler. So when they take the dog out the next time or tomorrow, we want to just have an activity that we know is going to go well for the dog and give them that opportunity to decompress. Because often, if we're thinking about it on the fly, sometimes we don't pick the best activity to go back to, or we can struggle. But if we've got it written down and we've already thought about it and we know what activities that individual enjoys and copes with, it just makes it easier for everybody.
Yeah. No, that's a brilliant system and a brilliant way to explain it. So, this was a fabulous conversation and I'm so happy that we covered so much in a relatively short amount of time. Is there anything we didn't touch on that you think people need to know about fearful dogs in shelter environments?
I think we did a pretty good job of going through a lot of different things. I think it's just important that you just remember that, all of this stuff is great advice and will work for most dogs. But if you're trying it and you're not really seeing improvement, just try and find a good positive reinforcement based trainer who can kind of just look a bit more individually at your dog. Because another big part of any work we do with shelter dogs or any other dogs in homes is that individuality. And making sure that things are tweaked, that that animal and the owner has the best opportunity to succeed.
And you have a podcast that you've started called Simplifying Shelter Behavior. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. So I started a Facebook group and a podcast this year. I was Simplifying Shelter Behavior, like you said. And the aim is just to get good tips, tricks, and practical support out for people working in shelter. I'm really lucky that the organizations that I work with have behavior teams, but I know most rescues don't have that, and I just want there to be some a place for people to go. So on the Facebook page, I put out different videos of dogs that I'm working with or different suggestions that I've come across over the years. And then the podcast, I've been really lucky to have some really great
Oh,
shelter
yeah.
people who are sharing their experience because we've all got so much to kind of teach each other based off the experiences that we've had.
That's great. I'm so glad that you're out there doing this.
Thanks.
And where can our listeners find out more about you and your work? Do you have a website?
Yeah, so the best place to go is that Facebook group, so Simplifying Shelter Behavior, and then the podcast is on Spotify and Apple Podcasts.
Amazing. We'll put all those links in the show notes.
Brilliant. Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. This has been a wonderful conversation. We're grateful for your time. Thanks for tuning in. If you liked this episode, don't forget to rate and review. It helps other folks like you find the show. Thanks to Mike Pesci for the original music and James Eade of Be Heard for production. For show notes and transcripts, visit podtotherescue.com. Let us know what you think about this episode on social media. We're at Pod to the Rescue on Facebook and Instagram, and we love connecting with listeners. We'll catch you next time on Pod to the Rescue. Oh, and tell your dog we said hi.